Yud-Bes Tishri, Monday, 10th of October, Rabbi Aaron Hirsch, False Messiahs, Part 2, The Witch Hunt Against the Ramchal.
As we mentioned last time, when we were dealing directly with Shabtai Tzvi, there have been quite a number of episodes during Klal Yisrael's Golus where an individual has appeared and claimed to be Mashiach, or it was claimed about him. The most striking Mashiach, which occurred but is somewhat unknown, took place in the times of the Rambam, where there was this individual in Yemen who they said was Mashiach, and the Rambam writes in a letter that eventually the leader of the country captured this individual and said to him, "Prove that you're Mashiach." So as the Rambam writes, he said, "You can cut off my head and I will live." And they did and he didn't. And the Rambam said, and there's still those who still believe he's Mashiach, even after that. But these episodes, as we will see, were locally contained. The effect of this individual rarely meant that after the end, or maybe a generation after, there was any belief, and definitely it meant that there was no real effect of this individual having lived. In Shabtai Tzvi's case, it was very, very different. As we mentioned last time, perhaps as many as 20% of the Jews at the time, be they Sephardi or Ashkenazi, believed in Shabtai Tzvi and believed wholeheartedly in Shabtai Tzvi, to the extent that they were selling their possessions. There was a tshuva, an hisoros to tshuva, that had not been seen in Klal Yisrael's times, definitely not during Golus. And therefore, people invested very heavily in this belief. And there were Rabbonim who believed, and there's no reason they shouldn't believe, because he was fulfilling that which they either said or knew of, namely the tenets of Emunah, that at any moment Mashiach could be coming. And therefore, when there was the original disappointment of Shabtai Tzvi converting to Islam, and eventually when he died, there was a crisis, and there needed to be some way of restoring to people the ability to move forward. And the after effects would resonate throughout the next century, as we will see. Let's deal, firstly, with the simple history that would follow. So, Shabtai Tzvi had his Elio HaNovi, so to speak, Nathan of Gaza, who, of course, was not tainted by the fact that he had converted, because he was uninvolved in that part of Shabtai Tzvi's life, and therefore, as a Jew, he merited to be buried in a cave of Yisrael, in Skopje in Macedonia. And in fact, they would come on his yacht site, they would come and make a hilula and a whole series of tefillas and light candles at his keva. He, after the death of Shabtai Tzvi, was still travelling around Europe and spreading the word. Now, what exactly the word was is not clear, but it is clear that he wrote Sifrei Kabbalah, as did Shabtai Tzvi, which minimally bordered on the legitimate, meaning that these were texts that were needed to be substantially knowledgeable in Kabbalah to author in the first place. We're not talking about lightweights. These were people who understood areas of Torah thoroughly enough to be able to compose svarim on them. He came to Italy at one moment in time, at a given moment. He wanted to come into Venice. He was prevented from coming in. He got some non-Jews to help him out. And eventually, Rav Moshe Zakuto, who was the Rebbe of Rav Binyamin Cohen, who was the father-in-law of Rav Shai Bassam, both all eshalshelos of Kabbalah. Rav Shai Bassam was the first teacher of Kabbalah to the Ramchal. So Rav Moshe Zakuto prevented him coming in and teaching. And he got him to sign a letter to the effect that I, Nosson of Aza, was wrong in following the Mashiach Sheker. But eventually he really did what he wanted anyway. And he travelled on to various other towns in Italy, some of whom were completely convinced. Long after Nosson of Aza, after Shabtai Tzvi had died, they were still complete ma'aminim in Shabtai Tzvi, in Shabtos. And after him, there came, in the beginning of the 1700s, this is all in the late 1600s, there came Nechemia Chiyun in the beginning of the 1700s, also in Europe. There were the Frankists who caused a lot of trouble for Klal Yisrael. Their beliefs were intermingled with Christianity. And here there was no pretense that these were people of knowledge, of learning. They were at best extremely confused and at worst people who caused sorrows for Klal Yisrael. And of course, at this same time, you also have, in Amsterdam, you have Baruch Spinoza, who will be excommunicated by the Kehillah for his views, which were heretical. But it all adds fuel to the fire, because it all leads to questions. Klal Yisrael are not sure what they should now be doing. And a system that has been working for 1500 years in Golus is starting to become frayed at the edges. It will also lead, in the 1700s, to other movements which we will come to. But the truth is that the history side of it misses the point. That's not where it's really at. Shabtai Tzvi created what would be called in philosophical terms an existential crisis, meaning Klal Yisrael no longer knew who they could trust. They put their faith in an individual who seemed to pass all the tests that were required in order to be a person of trust, of faith. And this was a question that was not just being asked by the Hamoin Am. That's the general view. You know, they were disappointed, and now what should they do about it? The Chachomim no longer knew who they could trust, nor how to ensure that in the future this wouldn't happen again. If it is so close to the MS, then who is there who's going to discern, right, lahavchin ben tov l'ra, who is going to be able to carry that achrayas? Bearing in mind that the protagonists were Talmidei Chachomim, and what Klal Yisrael did, how they reacted, is the pathway to Mashiach. That's what you're supposed to do. Do tshuva. And to an extent, even if Shabtai Tzvi was not Mashiach, the tshuva that Klal Yisrael did, which was unprecedented, should surely have had some effect, should have changed the destiny of Klal Yisrael. And if it didn't, then the question that has to be asked is so fundamental to Klal Yisrael's Emunah. Is it actually true anymore? Because we did this all. And mamash, it didn't help in the slightest. And what we have to understand is the damage that happened to the Emunah of Klal Yisrael. It is comparable, I suppose, closer to our days, to how many of Klal Yisrael would have seen themselves, maybe in 1946, when they were now aware of a fuller picture of what had taken place to Klal Yisrael, and there was nothing there that gave them any hope. No one extended a hand to them as a nation which would lead to some sort of meaning to the previous decade. It was a time of tremendous confusion. Now, the truth is that post the Holocaust, there was so much tsar that people were building forwards, and generally people that managed to survive in spirit and soul were people who looked forward. And therefore they didn't have time to ask the question, and they didn't have time to mourn. But were they to have done so, they would have been gripped by a sense of, but tzaddikim were wiped out, kehillas were wiped out. What for? Where are we going with this? It was virtually a bankruptcy of Judaism. So that different answers were being provided by the person in the street and by Gedolim to a question which in a way is unanswerable. However, there came out of this an understanding that Klal Yisrael is not able to see how a tikkun is being affected. Rather than saying there was no tikkun at all, what we have to see it as is a change that is taking place, which is hidden. But it's the beginning of an unfolding. And it was explained in the equivalent of Yaakov at the beginning of Vayeshev. Bikesh Yaakov Leishev B'shalva Kofatz Olav Rugzei Shel Yosef. So here he's gone through a golus, and he's gone through a separation from Eretz Yisrael, and now he comes back, and yet what happens to him is that Yosef is the cause of 2 decades of tsar. Why? In order to bring about Mitzrayim and the Geulas Mitzrayim. But it was all hidden. And the way it was seen was in terms of the Tochacha in the Torah. The first Golus ends V'af Gamzois. Parashas B'chukosai Le'ma'astim, HaKadosh Baruch Hu will never entirely reject us. V'zocharti Esprisi Yaakov V'af Es Yitzchak V'af Esprisi Avraham Esker. That there will be Z'chus Avos that will bring about the Ge'ulah. But if you look at the second set of klolos in Kisavai, so the end of the klolos is the idea that we will, in an attempt to stave off the designs by our enemies to annihilate us, we will sell ourselves la'avodim v'lishvachos to our enemies. And they won't be interested even in buying us as avodim, because they just want our end. And then the next pasuk is Ele Divrei Habris. That's it. That's the end of the Tochacha in Kisavai. There is no hope expressed in the second Tochacha. Why? Because the second Geula is Geulas Moshe. And in the same way, when Klal Yisrael were to be redeemed from Mitzrayim, Moshe appears on the scene, and what happens? Tichvad aleim, Savoida. Things got worse. All they saw was confusion. All they saw was darkness. To the extent that even Moshe complains to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, why? Why did I have to be the messenger to bring about this this tzara? And therefore, the way Moshiach will be revealed is there will be a revelation, and then it'll be hidden, and maybe get worse, and then there will be the final geula. Fine. Enter the Ramchal. Now, we have to understand what Italy, especially northern Italy, was like during these centuries. It was a place where the debate raged between the artistic and the rationalist and the Kabbalist. You had different expressions of Yiddishkeit in Italy, and they did not necessarily see eye to eye. In northern Italy, places like Padua, where the Ramchal was born and lived, and Venice, had three kehillas living side by side, even when the kehilla numbered 1,500. And the three kehillas were Ashkenazi, who were generally the first of the three kehillas. There were the Spanish kehillas that had come from Spain and Portugal after the expulsion, and there were the Nusach Italki, the Italian kehillas. They had their own kehilla structure, and generally there was an overall understanding between them, but they lived different lives, and it meant that there could be a full expression of different ways of Yiddishkeit within the same town, very different to one another. The Ramchal was born in 1707 and died before he was 40 years old in 1746, died in Eretz Yisrael. Before his bar mitzvah, he was fluent in Kabbalah. Ad kedei kach that Rabbi Shaya Basan, who we mentioned, was his Rebbe, but was only his Rebbe till he was 15. And he was one of the foremost Mekubalim of his time. See, if he was teaching a teenager, he wasn't wasting his time teaching Kabbalah to a teenager. He had smicha before he was 18. When I was there in Padua, the Rav there showed me the photocopy of the Ksav Smicha that he was given. He was young enough that they didn't address him with the full title. It's a Ksav where three people are being given Smicha at the same time. One is Rav Moshe David Varney, who was a Talmid or a Talmid Chover of his, but who was older, and therefore he is called HaChover. But the Ramchal isn't, because he's so young at the time when he gets smicha. And from the age of 20 onwards, he is teaching and writing Kabbalah, and he is part of a group that between them are learning Torah without interruption 24 hours a day, every day of the week. And there is a cycle. And before the person finishes his cycle, the next person is already starting. So that there's an uninterrupted learning of Torah, the Mevakshei Hashem. They are learning Torah continuously, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. He will write Svarim with thousands of pages. He writes a Sefer on Keheles, over 3,000 pages long, with a Perush al Pi Kabbalah. He, of course, is brilliant. He is also single, unmarried. He is saying that I have been told by Magidim in Shemayim to do what I am doing. And this will raise all the alarm bells possible. This is exactly what Shabtai Tzvi was. There is at this moment in time no difference between them. in terms of their definition and in terms of what they are actually doing. At the age of 22, 23, Rabbi Yekutiel Gordon writes a letter and expresses amazement. He is part of this Chabura. He expresses amazement at what is happening, the revolution that is taking place, the Torah that is being brought into the world by this young person. And this letter will eventually fall into the hands of Rav Moshe Chagiz, who at that time is living in Altona in Germany, who will see in it every possible negative outcome, will view it from one perspective only, and that is that this is unbelievably dangerous to Klal Yisrael, and will come down against the Ramchal with the full weight of any power invested in him and in the Bote Dinim, and will urge the Venice Beis Din to get involved and to bring an end to what the Ramchal is doing. We will see soon why Rav Moshe Chagiz was such a lechem. Sorry? What was he? He was teaching Kabbalah at a very young age, and in a way that it hadn't been taught until now, and with chidushim to Kabbalah, which he said were coming to him from Magidim. This is very dangerous. So there was a heskem that he would not teach anything new. He would be allowed, he wouldn't write anything new, wouldn't teach anything new, he would be allowed to carry on learning the Sifrei Kabbalah such as they existed until that moment in time. And he also would, within the next 12 months or so, get married, and this would also make people more reassured that he's going in the derech of Klal Yisrael. However, that didn't last for very long. And by 1735, he was basically forced out of Italy. They had already confiscated some of his svarim and some of his writings the first time round, but here, basically, he felt that there was no possibility for him to carry on doing what he was doing. So he left. He travelled via Germany, and there he presented himself to the Rabbonim, and in one case the result was that they confiscated even more of his writings, and beyond those that were originally taken from him and have gone, we have no idea where they are. They say it was either hidden, or it was, in other words, gomus, or it was burnt, but we have no idea where those writings are, and all the writings that were then taken from him in Germany have also disappeared. And from there he went on to Amsterdam. In Amsterdam he was able to live initially as a posh yid. He made his living by being involved in grinding of glass, diamonds, etc. And eventually he started teaching Torah there. It was only there that he published the Mesillas Yesharim. And from there he travelled to Eretz Yisrael. And in 1746 there was a plague when he was in Akko, and he died as a result, and he is buried, as you are aware, in Tveria. Now, this is the Preseed version. Why was Rav Moshe Chagiz such a lechem? Because his father, Rav Yaakov Chagiz, lived in Eretz Yisrael and was one of the teachers of Nosson of Gaza, of Nathan of Gaza. And it was he, amongst others, who pronounced a cheirim against Nathan of Gaza in 1664. And he'd seen it all happening before. And therefore, he was not prepared to take any risks. Not that he saw it as a risk. He was convinced that this is a problem. He had no tzad sofek whatsoever. But he wasn't prepared to take any risks. Now, the problem in understanding who the Ramchal actually was is because he was such a genius. And I don't mean that in the simple sense of the word, that he was very advanced in a particular area, that he was very intelligent. I mean this in two very different ways. Firstly, he had multiple areas of Torah which he mastered. We all know that he wrote the Maseilas Yesharim. And depending which path the person took, they might be aware that he wrote Das Tzvunus, if they're into more Machshava philosophy. Or they might know that he wrote Derech Hashem. Or they might know that he wrote the Klach Pisrei Chochma, or the Adir Bamorim. Depends, these are works of pure Kabbalah. It depends which area a person's Natiya has taken them. They might be aware of more Sfarim. I doubt anybody has read the Lashain Limudim of the Ramchal. The Sfarim he wrote about how to learn Gemara. The Sfarim he wrote on grammar. And these Sfarim were written at the end of his life. The one on grammar, the Sefer Diktuk, was written in 1743. So it wasn't, you know, when he was young, so that's when he was involved in. Then he got into Kabbalah, and that's where he was. After he was involved in all these areas, that's when he was writing these types of Sfarim. He wrote poetry. He wrote plays. He wrote 150 Tehillim. In fact, when the Orain was dedicated in the Sfaradi Shul, in the Spanish Nusach Shul in Padua, he wrote a Chanukas HaOrain. These two are two of the Tehillim, because most of the 150 Tehillim did not survive. These are two that he wrote. We have altogether seven. The Orain still exists. It's in Rehov Hillel, where there is a Nusach Italki Shul. Very few of them left in the world, especially outside of Italy. And he wrote Tehillim in the style that we would have Tehillim, that we would find Tehillim today. So he was able to master areas which we have no knowledge of and no, I would virtually say, interest in. He was multifaceted, incredibly so. Beyond which, when we hear, for instance, that the Baal Shem Tov, or the Vilna Gaon, was spoken to by a Magid, Min HaShemayim. So we can conveniently file that piece of information away, because we have no details. So it means they were, you know, gehoven a mention. We don't really understand what it means, but it doesn't really bother us, because we don't have any details. But we do have very precise details about the Magid that would appear to the Ramchal, because he wrote about it to Rabbi Yamin Cohen, the Rebbe of Rabbi Shai Basan. He wrote as follows. On Rosh Chodesh Sivan, Tav Peches, he was saying a particular yichud, in other words, a particular way of constructing Shem Hashem, which you say over and over in order to meditate. And he fell into a trance. And when he awoke from the trance, he heard a voice saying, I have come down from Shemayim to reveal to you the seydos, the secrets of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And he says this voice then revealed was Megalos Sod to him. At the same time, the next day, he made sure he would be alone in the room, and more sages were revealed. And eventually he was told that the source of this is a Magid Min HaShemayim. He wasn't allowed to ask any questions, he wasn't on that level. But after 3 months, he told him, the Magid told him, which Yichudim to say, so that Elio HaNovi would appear to him. And then he told him to write this sefer on Keheles, style of the Zohar. And eventually, and this is written, confirmed by both the Ramchal and the letter of Rabbi Gutiel Gordon, the neshamas of Adam HaRishon, of David, of Avraham Avinu, of Moshe Rabbeinu, of Malachim, and he names which Malachim, appeared and taught Torah. And he writes, if you were to ask me sort of why I deserve this, it's come about because of Avas Hashem, Akadosh Baruch Hu's love for me, and nothing really to do with me. However, it is true that for years I have been reciting these Yichudim, and I perform a different Yichud every 15 minutes. We're talking about things that we have no shaychus to, but I just want to set the scene of why the Ramchal is seen differently to Gedolim, who also had a Yad in Kabbalah. And what was being said is that he is being taught Seders that have never been taught since the time of Rav Shimon bar Yochai. And this is 1500 years later. So, if you're Rav Moshe Chagiz, you get worried about this. It's important to understand that Nosson of Aza also said that he had a Magid, and that the Magid said to him that the Moshiach of Klal Yisrael is coming to Eretz Yisrael, just before Shabtai Tzvi's arrival. And that's why he believed in him. It's also important to understand that the Ramchal was familiar with the writings of Kabbalah of the Shabtai Tzvi. Now, it's true that he wrote a Sefer Kinas Hashem Tzvakos, in which essentially it's an attack on Christianity and more or less on the writings of Shabtai Tzvi. But things are far from being easy and clear-cut and to an outsider. In hindsight, and it didn't take very long for the hindsight to develop, because in the 1700s, right, he dies in 1746, in the 1700s, the Mezritch Magid and the Vilna Gaon, Mezritch Magid died in 1772, and the Vilna Gaon in 1797, so it's not that much afterwards, both of them spoke with tremendous shevach about the Ramchal. So it didn't take that long, but that's in hindsight. During his lifetime, there was a redifa against him, which meant that we lost at minimum 50% of his writings, all of which would be the equivalent of the Svarim that we have today. He wrote at least 80 Svarim, and he only started writing at 17. So in less than 20 years, and we're not talking about, you know, the sort of sefer that you give as, a present on the table at a chasna. Right? We're talking about Svarim, where even Das Tfunas, which is not Kabbalah, right? So it took Reb Chaim Friedlander, the Mashkiach in Polovich, to write a perush on it, so that we should understand what's going on. Right? Let alone the Sifrei Kabbalah. And this was Hashkoch Elyona. There's no other way to look at it. This is what HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted. That many of the Svarim should be hidden, shouldn't be known. And it's interesting. There is a person that he shares almost a common history with, and that's the Rambam. That he was in exile. He went from country to country. That eventually he would be claimed by everybody. And everybody in a different signon, Bialik, the national poet of Israel, claimed him as, in his writings about Eretz Yisrael and his poetry, as the first person who developed the modern language, and also with his grammatical skills. And then you have Rabbi Yisrael Salant talking about the Mesillas Yesharim. And then you have those who are learning Kabbalah. Each one is learning a completely different segment, so he's claimed by all. And his writings were confiscated or put into Cherem, the Rambam, after his lifetime. Neither of them ever responded to their enemies in a way which was negative. They defended themselves in terms of writing why they felt what they were doing was right, but they never detracted from anybody else. And of course, they're buried together. They are a few hundred yards away from each other in Tveria. a town in which neither was born, and they both ended up there. Having said that, the Svarim that we do have gave us an entry into multiple areas of Torah, and the damage, so to speak, was limited to the fact that in the Ramchal's lifetime, he was not able to teach the Torah that he should have, so to speak, taught. But there were not the fallout effects that happened with Shabtai Tzvi. And in that way, we were spared this episode. However, if the lifetime of Shabtai Tzvi was a nisayon for Klal Yisrael, if the life experiences of the Ramchal were difficult to understand, all of this is good preparation for part three, which is even more difficult to understand, and that is Rabbi Yonatan Eibershitz and Rabbi Yaakov Emden. How there was machlekes, and what each side actually meant. I'll tell you meiresh, there's no real answer, but we can fill in the details, and the details of those who took either side, and what was being said and learnt at the time. But a mahalach, all of these three episodes are sosum. And all of these three episodes took place over a 100-year period, which rocked Klal Yisrael. And as I mentioned last time, and we'll have to develop more the next time, the origins of reform on the one hand, and of Hasidus on the other hand, can be traced to what is going on here. Because people needed a solution that was not available at the time. They needed something that would either take the rationalist approach and see everything virtually in humanist terms, and that was reform, or something that would only see things in eschatological terms, in Zman Mashiach terms, in terms that would be pure Kabbalah, and that was Hasidus. So that's what happens as a result. But an understanding properly of what was going on is actually beyond us.